room is deliver a message.
The jailer yanked his leather strap free of Tyrion's grasp. Message, he said, as if he'd never heard the word before. His frown made deep creases in his brow.
You heard me, my lord. Only carry my word to your lady. Tell her...
What?
What would possibly make Lysa Arryn relent?
The inspiration came to Tyrion Lannister suddenly.
Tell her that I wish to confess my crimes.
Maud raised his arm, and Tyrion braced himself for another blow, but the turnkey hesitated. Suspicion and greed warred in his eyes. He wanted that gold, yet he feared a trick. He had the look of a man who had often been tricked.
It's lie, he muttered darkly. Dwarf man cheat me.
I will put my promise in writing, Tyrion vowed. Some illiterates held writing in disdain. Others seemed to have a superstitious reverence for the written word, as if it were some sort of magic. Fortunately, Maud was one of the latter. The turnkey lowered the strap.
Writing down gold, much gold.
Oh, much gold, Tyrion assured him. The purse is just a taste, my friend. My brother wears armor of solid gold plate.
In truth, Jaime's armor was gilded steel, but this oaf would never know the difference. Maud fingered his strap thoughtfully, but in the end he relented and went to fetch paper and ink. When the letter was written, the jailer frowned at it suspiciously.
Now deliver my message, Tyrion urged.
He was shivering in his sleep when they came for him, late that night. Maud opened the door but kept his silence. Sir Varys Egan woke Tyrion with the point of his boot.
On your feet, imp. My lady wants to see you.
Tyrion rubbed the sleep from his eyes and put on a grimace he scarcely felt.
No doubt she does, but what makes you think I wish to see her?
Sir Varys frowned. Tyrion remembered him well from the years he had spent at King's Landing as the captain of the Hand's household guard, a square, plain face, silver hair, heavy build, and no humour whatsoever.
Your wishes are not my concern. On your feet, or I'll have you carried.
Tyrion clambered awkwardly to his feet.
A cold night, he said casually, and the high hall is so draughty. I don't wish to catch a chill. Maud, if you would be so good, fetch my cloak.
The jailer squinted at him, face dull with suspicion.
My cloak, Tyrion repeated. The shadowskin you took from me for safekeeping, you recall?
Get him the damnable cloak, Sir Varys said.
Maud did not dare grumble. He gave Tyrion a glare that promised future retribution, yet he went for the cloak. When he draped it around his prisoner's neck, Tyrion smiled.
My thanks. I shall think of you whenever I wear it.
He flung the trailing end of the long fur over his right shoulder, and felt warm for the first time in days.
Lead on, Sir Varys.
The high hall of the Arryns was aglow with the light of 50 torches, burning in the sconces along the walls. The Lady Lysa wore black silk, with a moon and falcon sewn on her breast in pearls. Since she did not look the sort to join the Night's Watch, Tyrion could only imagine that she had decided mourning clothes were appropriate garb for a confession. Her long auburn hair, woven into an elaborate braid, fell across her left shoulder. The taller throne beside her was empty. No doubt the little lord of the area was off, shaking in his sleep. Tyrion was thankful for that much, at least. He bowed deeply and took a moment to glance around the hall. Lady Arryn had summoned her knights and retainers to hear his confession, as he had hoped. He saw Sir Brynden Tully's craggy face and Lord Nestor Royce's bluff one. Beside Nestor stood a younger man with fierce black side whiskers who could only be his heir, Sir Albar. Most of the principal houses of the Vale were represented. Tyrion noted Sir Lynn Corbray, slender as a sword, Lord Hunter, with his gouty legs, the widowed Lady Wainwood, surrounded by her sons. Others sported sigils he did not know, broken lance, green viper, burning tower, wing chalice. Among the Lords of the Vale were several of his companions from the high road. Sir Roderick Cassell, pale from half-heel wounds, stood with Sir Willis Wode beside him. Marillion the singer had found a new wood harp. Tyrion smiled. Whatever happened here tonight, he did not wish it to happen in secret, and there was no one like a singer for spreading a story near and far. In the rear of the hall, Bronn lounged beneath a pillar. The free rider's black eyes were fixed on Tyrion, and his hand lay lightly on the pommel of his sword. Tyrion gave him a long look, wondering. Catelyn Stark spoke first. "You wish to confess your crimes, we're told?" "I do, my lady," Tyrion answered. Lysa Arryn smiled at her sister. "The sky cells always break them. The guards can see them there, and there's no darkness to hide in." "He does not look broken to me," Lady Catelyn said. Lady Lysa paid her no mind. "Say what you will," she commanded Tyrion. "And now to roll the dice," he thought, with another quick glance back at Bronn. "Where to begin, eh? I'm a vile little man, I confess it. My crimes and sins are beyond counting, my lords and ladies. I have lain with whores, not once, but hundreds of times. I have wished my own lord father dead, and my sister, our gracious queen as well." Behind him someone chuckled. "I have not always treated my servants with kindness. I have gambled. I have even cheated, I blush to admit. I have said many cruel and malicious things about the noble lords and ladies of the court." That drew outright laughter. "Once I—" "Silence!" Lysa Arryn's pale round face had turned a burning pink. "What do you imagine you're doing, dwarf?" Tyrion cocked his head to one side. "Why, confessing my crimes, my lady." Catelyn Stark took a step forward. "You are accused of sending a hard knife to slay my son Bran in his bed, and of conspiring to murder Lord John Arryn, the Hand of the King." Tyrion gave a helpless shrug. "Those crimes I cannot confess, I fear. I know nothing of any murders." Lady Lysa rose from her weirwood throne. "I will not be made muck of. You have had your little jape, imp. I trust you enjoyed it. Sir Vardis, take him back to the dungeons, but this time find him a smaller cell, with a floor more sharply sloped." "Is this how justice is done in the Vale?" Tyrion roared so loudly that Sir Vardis froze for a moment. "Does honour stop at the bloody gate? You accuse me of crimes. I deny them. So you throw me into an open cell to freeze and starve?" He lifted his head to give them all a good look at the bruises Mort had left on his face. "Where is the king's justice? Is this Aerie not part of the Seven Kingdoms? I stand accused, you say, very well. I demand a trial. Let me speak, and let my truth or falsehood be judged openly in the sight of gods and men." A low murmuring filled the high hall. He had her, Tyrion knew. He was high-born, the son of the most powerful lord in the realm, the brother of the queen. He could not be denied a trial. Guardsmen, in sky-blue cloaks, had started towards Tyrion, but Sir Vardis bid them halt and looked to Lady Lysa. Her small mouth twitched in a petulant smile. "If you are tried and found to be guilty of the crimes for which you stand accused, then by the king's own laws you must pay with your own life's blood. We keep no headsmen in the Eyrie, my lord of Lannister. Open the moon door." The press of spectators parted.
A narrow, weirwood door stood between two slender marble pillars, a crescent moon carved in the white wood. Those standing closest edged backward as a pair of guardsmen marched through. One man removed the heavy bronze bars, the second pulled the door inward. Their blue cloaks rose snapping from their shoulders, caught in the sudden gust of wind that came howling through the open door. Beyond was the emptiness of the night sky, speckled with cold, uncaring stars. "Behold the king's justice," Lysa Aaron said. Torch flames fluttered like pennons along the wall, and here and there the odd torch guttered out. "Lysa, I think this unwise," Catelyn Stark said, as the black wind swirled around the hall. Her sister ignored her. "You want a trial, my Lord of Lannister?" "Very well, a trial you shall have. My son will listen to whatever you care to say, and you shall hear his judgment. Then you may leave, by one door or the other." She looked so pleased with herself, Tyrion thought, and small wonder. How could a trial threaten her when her weakling son was the Lord Judge? Tyrion glanced at her moon door.
"Mother, I want to see him fly," the boy had said.
How many men had the snot-nosed little wretch sent through that door already?
"I thank you, my good lady, but I see no need to trouble Lord Robert," Tyrion said politely. "The guards know the truth of my innocence. I will have their verdict, not the judgment of men. I demand trial by combat."
A storm of sudden laughter filled the high hall of the Aerons. Lord Nestor Royce snorted. Sir Willis chuckled. Sir Lynn Corbray guffawed. And others threw back their heads and howled until tears ran down their faces. Marillion clumsily plucked a gay note on his new wood harp with the fingers of his broken hand. Even the wind seemed to whistle with derision as it came skirling through the moon door. Lysa Aaron's watery blue eyes looked uncertain. He had caught her off balance. "You have that right, to be sure." The young knight with a green viper emblazoned on his surcoat stepped forward and went to one knee. "My lady, I beg the boon of championing your cause." "The honour should be mine," old Lord Hunter said. "For the love I bore your lord husband, let me avenge his death." "My father served Lord John faithfully as High Steward of the Vale," Sir Albar Royce boomed. "Let me serve his son in this." "The guards favour the man with a just cause," said Sir Lynn Corbray. "Yet often that turns out to be the man with the surer sword. We all know who that is," he smiled modestly. A dozen other men all spoke at once, clamouring to be heard. Tyrion found it disheartening to realize so many strangers were eager to kill him. Perhaps this had not been such a clever plan after all. Lady Lysa raised a hand for silence. "I thank you, my lords, as I know my son would thank you if he were among us. No men in the Seven Kingdoms are so bold and true as the Knights of the Vale. Would that I could grant you all this honour. Yet I can choose only one," she gestured. "Sir Vardis Egan, you were ever my lord husband's good right hand. You shall be our champion." Sir Vardis had been singularly silent. "My lady," he said gravely, sinking to one knee, "pray give this burden to another. I have no taste for it. The man is no warrior. Look at him. A dwarf, half my size, and lame in the legs. It would be shameful to slaughter such a man and call it justice." "Oh, excellent," Tyrion thought. "I agree." Lysa glared at him. "You demanded a trial by combat. And now I demand a champion, such as you have chosen for yourself. My brother Jaime will gladly take my part, I know." "Your precious Kingslayer is hundreds of leagues from here," snapped Lysa Aaron. "Send a bird for him. I will gladly await his arrival." You will face Sir Varys on the morrow. Singer, Tyrion said, turning to Marillion, when you make a ballad of this, be certain you tell them how Lady Arryn denied the dwarf the right to a champion, and sent him forth lame and bruised and hobbling to face her finest knight. I deny you nothing, Lysa Arryn said, her voice peeved and shrill with irritation. Name your champion, imp, if you think you can find a man to die for you. If it's all the same to you, I'd sooner find one to kill for me. Tyrion looked over the long hall. No one moved. For a long moment, he wondered if it had all been a colossal blunder. Then there was a stirring in the rear of the chamber.
I'll stand for the dwarf, Bronn called out.
Eddard. He dreamt an old dream, of three knights in white cloaks, and a tower long fallen, and Lyanna in a bed of blood. In the dream his friends rode with him, as they had in life. Proud Martin Cassel, Jory's father, faithful Theowal, Ethan Glover, who had been Brandon's squire, Sir Mark Riswell, soft of speech and gentle of heart, the Crannog man, Harlan Reed, Lord Dustin, on his great red stallion. Ned had known their faces as well as he knew his own once, but the years leech at a man's memories, even those he has vowed never to forget. In the dream they were only shadows, grey wraiths on horses made of mist. They were seven facing three, in the dream as it had been in life. Yet these were no ordinary three. They waited before the Round Tower, the red mountains of dawn at their backs, their white cloaks billowing in the wind. And these were no shadows. Their faces burned clear even now. Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning, had a sad smile on his lips. The hilt of the great sword Dawn poked up over his right shoulder. Sir Oswald Went was on one knee, sharpening his blade with a whetstone. Across his white enameled helm, the black bat of his house spread its wings. Between them stood fierce old Sir Gerald Hightower, the White Bull, Lord Commander of the King's Guard. "I looked for you on the Trident," Ned said to them. "We were not there," Sir Gerald answered. "Woe to the usurper if we had been," said Sir Oswald. "When King's Landing fell, Sir Jamie slew your king with a golden sword, and I wondered where you were." "Far away," Sir Gerald said, "or Ares would yet sit on the Iron Throne, and our false brother would burn in seven hells." "I came down on Storm's End to lift the siege," Ned told them, "and the Lords Tyrell and Redwine dipped their banners and all their knights bent their knee to pledge us fealty. I was certain you would be among them." "Our knees do not bend easily," said Sir Arthur Dane. "Sir Willem Darry is fled to Dragonstone with your queen and Prince Viserys. I thought you might have sailed with him."
"Sir Willem is a good man and true," said Sir Oswald. "But not of the King's Guard," Sir Gerard pointed out. "The King's Guard does not flee." "Then or now," said Sir Arthur. He donned his helm. "We swore a vow," explained old Sir Gerald. Ned's wraiths moved up beside him, with shadow swords in hand. They were seven against three. "And now it begins," said Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning. He unsheathed Dawn and held it with both hands. The blade was pale as milk glass, alive with light. "No," Ned said with sadness in his voice, "now it ends." As they came together in a rush of steel and shadow, he could hear Lyanna screaming, "Eddard!" she called. A storm of rose petals blew across a blood-streaked sky, as blue as the eyes of death. "Lord Eddard!" Lyanna called out again.
"I promise," he whispered. "Leah, I promise."
"Lord Eddard!"
a man echoed from the dark. Groaning, Eddard Stark opened his eyes. Moonlight streamed through the tall windows of the Tower of the Hand.
Lord Eddard.
A shadow stood over his bed.
How long?
The sheets were tangled, his legs splinted and plastered. A dull throb of pain shot up his side.
6 days and 7 nights, the voice was Van Poole's. The steward held a cup to Ned's lips. Drink, my lord.
What, only water?
Maester Purcell said you would be thirsty.
Ned drank. His lips were parched and cracked. The water tasted sweet as honey.
The king left orders, Van Poole told him, when the cup was empty. He would speak with you, my lord.
On the morrow, Ned said, when I am stronger. He could not face Robert now. The dream had left him weak as a kitten.
My lord, Poole said, he commanded us to send you to him the moment you opened your eyes.
The steward busied himself lighting a bedside candle. Ned cursed softly. Robert was never known for his patience.
Tell him I'm too weak to come to him. If he wishes to speak to me, I should be pleased to receive him here. I hope you wake him from a sound sleep and summon...
He was about to say Jory, when he remembered.
Summon the captain of my guard.
Alan stepped into the bedchamber a few moments after the steward had taken his leave.
My lord?
Poole tells me it has been 6 days, Ned said. I must know how things stand.
The Kingslayer has fled the city, Alan told him. The talk is he's ridden back to a Castle Rock to join his father. The story of how Lady Catelyn took the imp is on every lip. I have put on extra guard, if it please you.
It does, Ned assured him. My daughters?
They have been with you every day, my lord. Sansa prays quietly, but Arya...
He hesitated. She has not said a word since they brought you back. She is a fierce little thing, my lord. I have never seen such anger in a girl. Whatever happens, Ned said, I want my daughters kept safe. I fear this is only the beginning.
No harm will come to them, Lord Eddard, Alan said. I stake my life on that.
Jory and the others?
I gave them over to the Silent Sisters to be sent north to Winterfell. Jory would want to lie beside his grandfather.
It would have to be his grandfather, for Jory's father was buried far to the south. Martin Castell had perished with the rest. Ned had pulled the tower down afterward and used its bloody stones to build 8 cairns upon the ridge. It was said that Rhaegar had named the place the Tower of Joy. But for Ned, it was a bitter memory. They had been 7 against 3, yet only 2 had lived to ride away. Eddard Stark himself, and the little Crannog man, Howland Reed. He did not think it omened well that he should dream that dream again, after so many years.
You've done well, Alan, Ned was saying when Vaan Poole returned. The steward bowed low. His grace is without, my lord, and the queen with him. Ned pushed himself up higher, wincing as his leg trembled with pain. He had not expected Cersei to come. It did not bode well that she had.
Send them in and leave us. What we have to say should not go beyond these walls. Poole withdrew quietly. Robert had taken time to dress. He wore a black velvet doublet with a crown stag of Baratheon worked upon the breast in golden thread, and a golden mantle with a cloak of black and gold squares. A flagon of wine in his hand, his face already flushed from drink. Cersei Lannister entered behind him, a jewel tiara in her hair.
Your grace, Ned said, your pardons, I cannot rise.
No matter,
the king said gruffly.
Some wine, eh, from the arbor, a good vintage.
A small cup, Ned said. My head is still heavy from the milk of the puppy.
A man in your place should count himself fortunate that his head is still on his shoulders, the queen declared.
Quiet, woman, Robert snapped.
He brought Ned a cup of wine. Does the leg still pain you?
Some, Ned said. His head was swimming, but it would not do to admit to weakness in front of the queen.
Pycelle swears it will heal clean, Robert frowned. I take it you know what Catelyn has done.
I do. Ned took a small swallow of wine. "My lady wife is blameless, Your Grace. All she did at my command."
"I'm not pleased, Ned," Robert grumbled.
"By what right do you dare lay hands on my blood?" Cersei demanded. "Who do you think you are?"
"The hand of the king," Ned told her with icy courtesy. "Charged by your own lord husband to keep the king's peace and enforce the king's justice."
"You were the hand of the king," Cersei began, "but now—"
"Silence!" the king roared. "You asked him a question, and he answered it."
Cersei subsided, cold with anger, and Robert turned back to Ned.
"Keep the king's peace, you say. Is that how you keep the king's peace, Ned?"
"Seven men are dead." "Eight," the queen corrected. "Tregar died this morning of the blow Lord Stark gave him."
"Abductions on the king's road and drunken slaughter in the streets," the king said. "I will not have it, Ned."
"Catelyn had good reason for taking the imp."
"I said I will not have it. To hell with her reasons. You will command her to release the dwarf at once, and you will make your peace with Jaime."
"Three of my men were butchered before my eyes because Jaime Lannister wished to chasten me.
Am I to forget that?"
"My brother was not the cause of the quarrel," Cersei told the king. "Lord Stark was returning drunk from a brothel. His men attacked Jaime and his guards, even as his wife attacked Tyrion on the king's road."
"You know me better than that, Robert," Ned said. "Ask Lord Baelish if you doubt me. He was there."
"I've talked to Littlefinger," Robert said. "He claims he rode off to bring the gold cloaks before the fighting began, but he admits you were returning from some whorehouse."
"Some whorehouse? Damn your eyes, Robert. I went there to have a look at your daughter. Her mother has named her Bara. She looks like that first girl you fathered, when we were boys together in the Vale." He watched the queen as he spoke. Her face was a mask, still and pale, betraying nothing. Robert flushed.
"Bara," he grumbled, "is that supposed to please me? Damn the girl, I thought she had more sense."
"She cannot be more than 15, and a whore. And you thought she had sense?" Ned said, incredulous. His leg was beginning to pain him sorely. It was hard to keep his temper. "The fool child is in love with you, Robert." The king glanced at Cersei.
"This is no fit subject for the queen's ears."
"Her Grace will have no liking for anything I have to say," Ned replied. "I am told the Kingslayer has fled the city. Give me leave to bring him back to justice." The king swirled the wine in his cup, brooding. He took a swallow.
"No," he said. "I want no more of this. Jaime slew three of your men, and you five of his. Now it ends."
"Is that your notion of justice?" Ned flared. "If so, I am pleased that I am no longer your hand." The queen looked to her husband. "If any man had dared to speak to a Targaryen as he has spoken to you—"
"Did you take me for Aerys?" Robert interrupted.
"I took you for a king. Jaime and Tyrion are your own brothers by all the laws of marriage and the bonds we share. The Starks have driven off the one and seized the other. This man dishonors you with every breath he takes, and yet you stand there meekly, asking if his leg pains him, and would he like some wine?"
Robert's face was dark with anger.
"How many times must I tell you to hold your tongue, woman?"
Cersei's face was a study in contempt. "What a jape the gods have made of us two," she said.
"By all rights, you ought to be in skirts, and me in mail."
Purple with rage, the king lashed out, a vicious backhand blow to the side of the head. She stumbled against the table and fell hard. Yet Cersei Lannister did not cry out. Her slender fingers brushed her cheek, where the pale smooth skin was already reddening. On the morrow, the bruise would cover half her face. "I shall wear this as a badge of honor," she announced.
"Wear it in silence, or I'll honor you again," Robert vowed.
He shouted for a guard. Sir Meryn Trant stepped into the room, tall and somber in his white armor.
"The queen is tired. See her to her bedchamber."
The knight helped Cersei to her feet and led her out without a word. Robert reached for the flagon and refilled his cup.
You see what she does to me, Ned?
The king seated himself, cradling his wine cup.
My loving wife, the mother of my children.
The rage was gone from him now. In his eyes, Ned saw something sad and scared.
I should not have hit her. That was not kingly.
He stared down at his hands, as if he did not quite know what they were.
I was always strong. No one could stand before me, no one. How do you fight someone if you can't hit them?
Confused, the king shook his head.
Rhaegar won. Damn him. I killed him, Ned. I drove the spike right through that black armor into his black heart, and he died at my feet. They made up songs about it. Yet somehow, he still won. He has Lyanna now, and I have her.
The king drained his cup. Your Grace, Ned Stark said, we must talk. Robert pressed his fingertips against his temples.
I'm sick unto death of talk, and the morrow I'm going to the king's wood to hunt. Whatever you have to say can wait until I return.
If the guards are good, I shall not be here on your return. You commanded me to return to Winterfell, remember? Robert stood up, grasping one of the bedposts to steady himself.
The guards are seldom good, Ned. Here, this is yours.
He pulled the heavy silver handclasp from a pocket in the lining of his cloak and tossed it on the bed.
Like it or not, you are my hand, damn you. I forbid you to leave.
Ned picked up the silver clasp. He was being given no choice, it seemed. His leg throbbed, and he felt as helpless as a child. The Targaryen girl, the king groaned.
Seven Hells, don't start with her again. That's done. I'll hear no more of it.
Why would you want me as your hand, if you refuse to listen to my counsel?
Why? Robert laughed. Why not? Somebody has to rule this damnable kingdom. Put on the badge, Ned. It suits you. And if you ever throw it in my face again, I swear to you, I'll pin the damn thing on Jaime Lannister.
Catelyn. The eastern sky was rose and gold as the sun broke over the Vale of Arryn. Catelyn Stark watched the light spread, her hands resting on the delicate carved stone of the balustrade outside her window. Below her the world turned from black to indigo to green as dawn crept across fields and forests. Pale white mists rose off Alyssa's tears, where the ghost waters plunged over the shoulder of the mountain to begin their long tumble down the face of the giant's lance. Catelyn could feel the faint touch of spray on her face. Alyssa Arryn had seen her husband, her brothers, and all her children slain, and yet in life she had never shed a tear. So in death the gods had decreed that she would know no rest until her weeping watered the black earth of the Vale, where the men she had loved were buried. Alyssa had been dead 6,000 years now, and still no drop of the torrent had ever reached the valley floor far below. Catelyn wondered how large a waterfall her own tears would make when she died. "Tell me the rest of it," she said.
"The king's there is messing a host at Casterly Rock,"
Sir Roderick Cassel answered from the room behind her.
"Your brother writes that he has sent riders to the rock, demanding that Lord Tywin proclaim his intent, but he has had no answer. Edmure has commanded Lord Vance and Lord Piper to guard the pass below the Golden Tooth. He advised you that he will yield no foot of Tully land without first watering it with Lannister blood."
Catelyn turned away from the sunrise. Its beauty did little to lighten her mood. It seemed cruel for a day to dawn so fair and end so foul as this one promised to. "Edmure has sent riders and made vows," she said, "but Edmure is not the Lord of Riverrun. What of my lord father?"
The message made no mention of Lord Hoster, my lady.
Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers. They had grown in white as snow and bristly as a thorn bush while he was recovering from his wounds. He looked almost himself again. My father would not have given the defence of Riverrun over to Edmure unless he was very sick, she said, worried. I should have been woken as soon as this bird arrived.
Your lady sister thought it better to let you sleep, Maester Coleman told me.
I should have been woken, she insisted.
Maester tells me your sister planned to speak with you after the combat, Sir Roderick said.
Then she still plans to go through with this mummer's farce? Catelyn grimaced. The dwarf has played her like a set of pipes, and she is too deaf to hear the tune. Whatever happens this morning, Sir Roderick, it is past time we took our leave. My place is at Winterfell with my sons. If you are strong enough to travel, I shall ask Lysa for an escort to see us to Gulltown. We can take ship from there.
Another ship?
Sir Roderick looked a shade green, yet he managed not to shudder.
Well, as you say, my lady.
The old knight waited outside her door as Catelyn summoned the servants Lysa had given her. If she spoke to her sister before the duel, perhaps she could change her mind, she thought, as they dressed her. Lysa's policies varied with her moods, and her moods changed hourly. The shy girl she had known at Riverrun had grown into a woman who was by turns proud, fearful, cruel, dreamy, reckless, timid, stubborn, vain, and above all, inconstant. When that vile turnkey of hers had come crawling to tell them that Tyrion Lannister wished to confess, Catelyn had urged Lysa to have the dwarf brought to them privately. But no, nothing would do but that her sister must make a show of him before half the Vale. And now this. "Lannister is my prisoner," she told Sir Roderick, as they descended the tower steps and made their way through the Eyrie's cold white halls. Catelyn wore plain grey wool with a silver belt. My sister must be reminded of that. At the doors to Lysa's apartment, they met her uncle storming out.
"Going to join the Fool's Festival?" Sir Brynden snapped. "I'd tell you to slap some sense into our sister if I don't do any good. Bet you'd only bruise your hand."
"There was a bird from Riverrun," Catelyn began. "A letter from Edmure."
"I know, child."
The black fish that fastened his cloak was Brynden's only concession to ornament.
"I had to hear it from Maester Coleman. I asked your sister for leave to take 1,000 seasoned men and ride for River Run with all haste. Do you know what she told me? The Vale cannot spare 1,000 swords, not even one, uncle, she said. You are the knight of the gate. Your place is here."
A gust of childish laughter drifted through the open doors behind him, and her uncle glanced darkly over his shoulder.
"Well, I told her she could bloody well find herself a new knight of the gate. Blackfish or no, I'm still a Tully. I shall leave for Riverrun by evenfall."
Catelyn could not pretend to surprise.
"Alone? You know as well as I that you will never survive the high road.
Sir Roderick and I are returning to Winterfell. Come with us, uncle. I will give you 1,000 men. Riverrun will not fight alone." Brynden thought for a moment, then nodded a brusque agreement.
"As you say, it's a long way home, but I'm more like to get there. I'll wait for you below."
He went striding off, his cloak swirling behind him. Catelyn exchanged a look with Sir Roderick. They went through the doors to the high, nervous sound of child's giggles. Lysa's apartments opened over a small garden, a circle of dirt and grass planted with blue flowers and ringed on all sides by tall white towers. The builders had intended it as a god's wood, but the area rested on the hard stone of the mountain, and no matter how much soil was hauled up from the Vale, they could not get a weirwood to take root here. So the lords of the area planted grass and scattered statuary amidst low flowering shrubs. It was there the two champions would meet to place their lives and that of Tyrion Lannister in the hands of the gods. Lysa, freshly scrubbed and garbed in cream velvet, with a rope of sapphires and moonstones around her milk-white neck, was holding court on the terrace, overlooking the scene of the combat, surrounded by her knights, retainers, and lords high and low. Most of them still hoped to wed her, bed her, and rule the Vale of Erin by her side. From what Catelyn had seen during her stay at the Eyrie, it was a vain hope. A wooden platform had been built to elevate Robert's chair. There the Lord of the Eyrie sat, giggling and clapping his hands, as a humpback puppeteer in blue and white motley made two wooden knights hack and slash at each other. Pitchers of thick cream and baskets of blackberries had been set out, and the guests were sipping a sweet, orange-scented wine from engraved silver cups.
A fool's festival, Brynden had called it, and small wonder.
Across the terrace, Lysa laughed gaily at some jest of Lord Hunter's and nibbled a blackberry from the point of Sir Lynn Corbray's dagger. They were the suitors who stood highest in Lysa's favour, today at least. Catelyn would have been hard-pressed to say which man was more unsuitable. Ian Hunter was even older than John Aaron had been. Half-crippled by gout and cursed with three quarrelsome sons, each more grasping than the last. Sir Lynn was a different sort of folly, lean and handsome, heir to an ancient but impoverished house, but vain, reckless, hot-tempered, and it was whispered, notoriously uninterested in the intimate charms of women. When Lysa espied Catelyn, she welcomed her with a sisterly embrace and a moist kiss on the cheek. "Isn't it a lovely morning? The gods are smiling on us. Do try a cup of wine, sweet sister. Lord Hunter was kind enough to send for it, from his own cellars."
"Thank you, no, Lysa, we must talk."
"After," her sister promised, already beginning to turn away from her. "Now," Catelyn spoke more loudly than she intended. Men were turning to look. "Lysa, you cannot mean to go ahead with this folly. Alive, the imp has value. Dead, he is only food for crows. And if his champion should prevail here—"
"A small chance of that, my lady,"
Lord Hunter assured her, patting her shoulder with a liver-spotted hand.
"Sir Varus is an artifactor. He'll make short work of that sellsword."
"Oh, will he, my lord?" Catelyn said coolly. "I wonder." She had seen Brun fight on the high road. It was no accident that he had survived the journey while other men had died. He moved like a panther, and that ugly sword of his seemed a part of his arm. Lysa's suitors were gathering around them like bees around a blossom. "Women understand little of these things," Sir Morton Wainwood said. "Sir Varys is a knight, sweet lady. This other fellow, well, his sort are all cowards at heart. Useful enough in a battle, with thousands of their fellows around them, but stand them up alone, and the manhood leaks right out of them."
"Say you have the truth of it, then," Catelyn said with a courtesy that made her mouth ache. "What will we gain by the dwarf's death? Do you imagine that Jamie will care a fig that we gave his brother a trial before we flung him off a mountain?"
"Behead the man," Sir Lynn Corbray suggested. "When the Kingslayer receives the imp's head, it will be a warning to him."
Lysa gave an impatient shake of her waist-long auburn hair. "Lord Robert wants to see him fly," she said, as if that settled the matter. "And the imp has only himself to blame. It was he who demanded a trial by combat."
"Lady Lysa has no honourable way to deny him, even if she wished to," Lord Hunter intoned ponderously.
Ignoring them all, Catelyn turned all her force on her sister. "I remind you, Tyrion Lannister is my prisoner. And I remind you the dwarf murdered my lord husband." Her voice rose. "He poisoned the hand of the king and left my sweet baby fatherless, and now I mean to see him pay." Whirling, her skirts swinging around her, Lysa stalked across the terrace. Sir Lynn and Sir Morton and the other suitors excused themselves with cool nods and trailed after her.
"Do you think he did?"
Sir Roderick asked her quietly when they were alone again.
Murder Lord John, that is. The imp still denies it, and most fiercely.
I believe the Lannisters murdered Lord Aaron, Catelyn replied, but whether it was Tyrion or Sir Jaime or the Queen, or all of them together, I could not begin to say. Lysa had named Cersei in the letter she had sent to Winterfell, but now she seems certain that Tyrion was a killer. Perhaps because the dwarf was here, while the Queen was safe behind the walls of the Red Keep, hundreds of leagues to the south. Catelyn almost wished she had burned her sister's letter before reading it. Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers.
Poison? Well, that could be the dwarf's work, true enough. Or Cersei's. It is said poison is the woman's weapon. Begging your pardon, my lady. The Kingslayer now, I have no great liking for the man, but he's not the sort. Too fond of the sight of blood on that golden sword of his. Was it poison, my lady?
Catelyn frowned, vaguely uneasy. How else could they make it look a natural death? Behind her, Lord Robert shrieked with delight, as one of the puppet knights sliced the other in half, spilling a flood of red sawdust onto the terrace. She glanced at her nephew and sighed. The boy is utterly without discipline. He will never be strong enough to rule unless he is taken away from his mother for a time.
His lord father agreed with you, said a voice at her elbow. She turned to behold Maester Coleman, a cup of wine in his hand. He was planning to send the boy to Dragonstone for flustering, you know. Oh, but I'm speaking out of turn.
The apple of his throat bubbed anxiously beneath the loose maester's chain.
I fear I've had too much of Lord Hunter's excellent wine. The prospect of bloodshed has my nerves all afraid.
You are mistaken, maester, Catelyn said. It was Castle Rock, not Dragonstone, and those arrangements were made after the hand's death, without my sister's consent. The maester's head jerked so vigorously at the end of his absurdly long neck that he looked half a puppet himself.
No, begging your forgiveness, my lady, but it was Lord John who...
A bell tolled loudly below them. High lords and serving girls alike broke off what they were doing and moved to the balustrade. Below, two guardsmen in sky-blue cloaks led forth Tyrion Lannister. The Aerys' plump septon escorted him to the statue in the centre of the garden, a weeping woman carved in vain white marble, no doubt meant to be Alyssa.
"The bad little man," Lord Robert said, giggly. "Mother, can I make him fly? I want to see him fly."
"Later, my sweet baby," Lysa promised.
"Trial first. Draw Sir Lynn Corbray, then execution."
A moment later, the two champions appeared from opposite sides of the garden. The knight was attended by two young squires, the sellsword by the Aerys' master-at-arms. Sir Vardas Egan was steel from head to heel, encased in heavy plate armour over mail and padded surcoat. Large circular rundles, enameled cream and blue in the moon and falcon sigil of House Aaron, protected the vulnerable junction of arm and breast. A skirt of lobstered metal covered him from waist to mid-thigh, while a solid gorget encircled his throat. Falcon wings sprouted from the temples of his helm, and his visor was a pointed metal beak with a narrow slit for vision. Bronn was so lightly armoured, he looked almost naked beside the knight. He wore only a shirt of black-oiled ringmail over boiled leather, a round steel half-helm with a nose-guard, and a mail coif. High leather boots with steel shin-guards gave some protection to his legs, and discs of black iron were sewn into the fingers of his gloves. Yet Catelyn noted that the sellsword stood half a hand taller than his foe, with a longer reach, and Bronn was 15 years younger, if she was any judge. They knelt in the grass beneath the weeping woman, facing each other, with Lannister between them. The septon removed a faceted crystal sphere from the soft cloth bag at his waist. He lifted it high above his head and the light shattered. Rainbows danced across the imp's face. In a high, solemn, sing-song voice, the Septon asked the gods to look down and bear witness, to find the truth in this man's soul, to grant him life and freedom if he was innocent, death if he was guilty. His voice echoed off the surrounding towers. When the last echo had died away, the Septon lowered the crystal and made a hasty departure. Tyrion leaned over and whispered something in Bronn's ear before the guardsman led him away. The sellsword rose laughing and brushed a blade of grass from his knee. Robert Aaron, Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale, was fidgeting impatiently in his elevated chair.
"When are they going to fight?"
he asked plaintively. Sir Vardis was helped back to his feet by one of the squires. The other brought him a triangular shield, almost 4 foot tall, heavy oak, dotted with iron studs. They strapped it to his left forearm. When Lysa's master-at-arms offered Bronn a similar shield, the sellsword spat and waved it away. 3 days' growth of coarse black beard covered his jaw and cheeks, but if he did not shave, it was not for the want of a razor. The edge of his sword had the dangerous glimmer of steel that had been honed every day for hours until it was too sharp to touch. Sir Vardis held out a gauntleted hand, and his squire placed a handsome double-edged longsword in his grasp. The blade was engraved with a delicate silver tracery of a mountain sky. Its pommel was a falcon's head, its crossguard fashioned into the shape of wings. "I had that sword carved for John in King's Landing," Lysa told her guest proudly as they watched Sir Vardis try a practice cut. "He wore it whenever he sat the Iron Throne in King Robert's place. Isn't it a lovely thing? I thought it only fitting that our champion avenged John with his own blade." The engraved silver blade was beautiful beyond a doubt, but it seemed to Catelyn that Sir Vardis might have been more comfortable with his own sword. Yet she said nothing. She was weary of futile arguments with her sister.
"Make them fight,"
Lord Robert called out. Sir Vardis faced the Lord of the Eyrie and lifted his sword in salute.
"For the Eyrie and the Vale."
Tyrion Lannister had been seated on a balcony across the garden, flanked by his guards. It was to him that Bronn turned with a cursory salute. "They await your command," Lady Lysa said to her lord's son.
"Fight!"
the boy screamed, his arms trembling as they clutched at his chair. Sir Vardis swiveled, bringing up his heavy shield. Bronn turned to face him. Their swords rang together, once, twice, at testing. The sellsword backed off a step. The knight came after, holding his shield before him. He tried a slash, but Bronn jerked back just out of reach, and the silver blade cut only air. Bronn circled to his right. Sir Vardis turned to follow, keeping his shield between them. The knight pressed forward, placing each foot carefully on the uneven ground. The sellsword gave way, a faint smile playing over his lips. Sir Vardis attacked, slashing, but Bronn leapt away from him, hopping lightly over a low, moss-covered stone. Now the sellsword circled left, away from the shield, towards the knight's unprotected side. Sir Vardis tried a hack at his legs, but did not have the reach. Bronn danced farther to his left. Sir Vardis turned in place.
"The man is craven," Lord Hunter declared. "Stand and fight, coward."
Other voices echoed the sentiment. Catelyn looked at Sir Roderick. Her master-at-arms gave a curt shake of his head.
"He wants to make Sir Vardis chase him. The weight of arm and shield would tire even the strongest man."
She had seen men practice at their sword play near every day of her life, had viewed 50 tourneys in her time, but this was something different and deadlier, a dance where the smallest misstep meant death. And as she watched, the memory of another duel in another time came back to Catelyn Stark, as vivid as if it had been yesterday. They met in the lower bailey of River Run. When Brandon saw that Ptah wore only helm and breastplate and mail, he took off most of his armour. Ptah had begged her for a favour he might wear, but she had turned him away. Her lord father promised her to Brandon Stark, and so it was to him that she gave her token, a pale blue handscarf she had embroidered with the leaping trot of River Run. As she pressed it into his hand, she pleaded with him. "He is only a foolish boy, but I have loved him like a brother, and it would grieve me to see him die." And her betrothed looked at her with the cool grey eyes of a Stark, and promised to spare the boy who loved her. That fight was over almost as soon as it began. Brandon was a man grown, and he drove Littlefinger all the way across the bailey and down the water stair, raining steel on him with every step, until the boy was staggering and bleeding from a dozen wounds. "Yield!" he called more than once. But Ptah would only shake his head and fight on grimly. When the river was lapping at their ankles, Brandon finally ended it with a brutal backhand cut that bit through Pataya's rings and leather into the soft flesh below the ribs, so deep that Catlin was certain that the wound was mortal. He looked at her as he fell and murmured, "Cat," as the bright blood came flowing out between his male fingers. She thought she had forgotten that. That was the last time she had seen his face, until the day she was brought before him in King's Landing. A fortnight passed before Littlefinger was strong enough to leave River Run, but her lord father forbade her to visit him in the tower where he lay abed. Lysa helped their maester nurse him. She had been softer and shyer in those days. Edmure had called on him as well, but Ptah had sent him away. Her brother had acted as Brandon's squire at the duel, and Littlefinger would not forgive that. As soon as he was strong enough to be moved, Lord Huster Tully sent Ptah Baelish away in a closed litter, to finish his healing on the fingers, upon the windswept jut of rock where he'd been born. The ringing clash of steel on steel jarred Catlin back to the present. Savardas was coming hard at Brunn, driving into him with shield and sword. The sellsword scrambled backward, checking each blow, stepping lightly over rock and root, his eyes never leaving his foe. He was quicker, Catlin saw. The knight's silvered sword never came near to touching him, but his own ugly grey blade hacked a notch from Savardas' shoulder plate. The brief flurry of fighting ended as swiftly as it had begun, when Brunn sidestepped and slid behind the statue of the weeping woman. Savardas lunged at where he had been, striking a spark off the pale marble of Alyssa's thigh.
"They're not fighting good, mother," the lord of the Eyrie complained. "I want them to fight."
"They will, sweet baby," his mother soothed him. "The sellsword can't run all day." Some of the lords on Lysa's terrace were making wry jests as they refilled their wine cups, but across the garden, Tyrion Lannister's mismatched eyes watched the champions dance as if there were nothing else in the world. Bronn came out from behind the statue, hard and fast, still moving left, aiming a two-handed cut at the knight's unshielded right side. Savardas blocked, but clumsily, and the sellsword's blade flashed upwards at his head. Metal rang, and a falcon's wing collapsed with a crunch. Savardas took a half-step back to brace himself, raised his shield. Oak chips flew as Bronn's sword hacked at the wooden wall. The sellsword stepped left again, away from the shield, and caught Savardas across the stomach, the razor edge of his blade leaving a bright gash where it bit into the knight's plate. Savardas drove forward off his back foot, his own silver blade descending in a savage arc. Brunn slammed it aside and danced away. The knight crashed into the weeping woman, rocking her on her plinth. Staggered, he stepped backward, his head turning this way and that as he searched for his foe. The slit visor of his helm narrowed his vision.
"Behind you, sir!"
Lord Hunter shouted, too late. Brun brought his sword down with both hands, catching Savardas in the elbow of his sword.